specifically. I wanted you to talk about, I know you talked about how you came to serve in the Black Panther Party, but I really wanted you to talk about specifically you in the Black Panther Party, not necessarily the Black Panther Party. What was it like serving as a medical doctor, volunteering? I know you weren't paid for your services. What kind of other interesting experiences did you have working with the people, working with the workers, serving the kids? Did you observe anything specifically about the free breakfast programs? What was it like traveling to China? And there are some aspects of it that you can talk about, but I would rather you not focus on that. I'd rather you focus on yourself and the Black Panther Party, not necessarily just the Black Panther Party, because this is about you.
Okay, that makes sense. The thing which, when I look back about the Panther Party, the positive feelings I have are for the rank and file, the troops who felt the need to create a better program, a better country, a country that would serve the needs of the people, that would serve the needs of the people for health care, for clothing. The fact that police brutality was raging through our community, and police were not so much interested in protecting poor people as they were in harassing poor people. And I personally was not involved in the free breakfast program, but I had a lot of admiration for the young men and women who would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get started cooking breakfast. They would get up at 4 and 5 o'clock to prepare breakfast for community kids. In fact, Steve Lovato, who was a physician, told me that when he was a kid growing up, that he used to go to the free breakfast program for the Panther Party. In fact, that pushed a lot of the government, because the government instituted a program to provide free breakfasts for poor kids who were not getting breakfasts at home before they go to school. And I think there was a tremendous spirit to try to serve the needs of the people and try to create programs, free shoes programs, free clothing programs, free breakfast programs, free health care programs. It was like a feeling that we were gonna create free clinics, we were going to create survival programs.
And serve the basic needs of the people.
Serve the basic needs of the people until there was a radical change in the government, or until there was a revolution that would cause these programs. And I think there was a tremendous feeling of giving, and there was a tremendous feeling of comradeship or brotherhood. And it was with this spirit that I was involved. I worked very long hours. In the beginning, I was working at the West Oakland Health Center from 2 to 8. Then on Monday and Wednesday nights, I would go to the clinic. And I sometimes would be there at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Did you stay up? Coffee?
No, I was young then. I didn't need coffee.
Wow.
As they used to say, in those days, they used to say you got high off the people. You know, there was a spirit of doing good which kept your energies going. We didn't need coffee. And I was visiting Angela Davis in prison twice a day, and it got so I would leave the health center. Twice a week. I would leave the health center, I think, on one of the nights, Wednesday. I would go to Marin County Prison. I would see her. I would come to go to the free clinic. It's amazing the hours I kept. It was interesting. I I've got a whole file of business with Angela. Finally got so Angela and I had to start writing because we would be in Marin County Jail, and the matron would go in the cell next to us and sit and listen to everything we had to say. This was supposedly confidential talk between doctor and patient. If we were to discuss anything non-medical, she would complain and said that I was not a doctor. So we had to actually start writing our messages to each other because of the fact that the matron in the jail would be in a cell next door with her head to the wall listening to every word we said. When I first went in to visit Angela, they wouldn't let me in. And the Sheldon Otis, who at that time was a prominent attorney, raised hell, blah, blah, and they still wouldn't let me in. I think they eventually got the judge to force Angela to have her own position. I think I was the source of helping keep her spirits up because, you know, she was in prison for, a long time. And I remember going to visit poor Randy Williams. He had got, apparently had tried to assassinate a couple of policemen on East 14th Street. I heard he had a machine gun and hand grenades or something. And I went to see him. In fact, I think we discovered that that's actually I got to meet my wife. Was it, believe it or not, she was beaten up in a court of law by police who went through. I think we discussed this in an earlier tape. And I was actually the first physician to go in the Adjustment Center of San Quentin, and George Jackson. I also went, was in the Adjustment Center of I don't know, you want to talk about my personal feelings. I think I talked about nothing specific other than going into prisons. I remember going to Folsom Prison, and the first time we drove up there, a lot of the politicians worked closely with the Panther Party because the Panther Party were a major force in the black community politically. Ron, they could call Ron Dellums up and ask him to jump, and Ron Dellums would say, how high? I think it was one Sunday evening we drove to Folsom Prison. Ron Dellums himself was up there because they asked me to check on David Hilliard. He had a bleeding ulcer. It's really ironic. They let Ron Dellums in, but they wouldn't let me in. And I'm the doctor, but he's the politician, so they gave him a tour of the prison. And then later on, they got a court order, and I went back, and we went to the Adjustment Center. I remember the doctor escorted me in. As we were walking in the tiers, he told me he always walks under the tier because he says he's worried about people throwing things down on him. And we got there, and I gave David a complete history and physical. He was having black stools, a bleeding ulcer, and I remember putting him on. We didn't have the great drugs we had there. We had stuff like anticholinergic drugs like probenton, which decreases the acid in the stomach. And actually, after I saw him, they actually had a Japanese physician from Sacramento come see him for his second opinion. And David actually told Ron Dellums that he thought we saved his life by going up there to visit him. But anyway, the thing about my personal interacting was people asked me about how is it like to be a doctor for a Panther Party. It was like being a doctor in any movement. It's a lot of work. Medicine is hard labor, no matter what you do. And, you know, I saw countless patients. I saw everyone from the newborn kids that the Panther women had to the leadership of the party. Anybody in the, every weekend the Panthers had this program, which I always thought to some extent was a waste of money, but they would fly, they would have their PE classes, they would fly the leadership from all over the East Coast out here to take the classes, and one time they were flying people out on weekends to take their classes, and then they would have the people in leadership roles would always be out here, and so I would be interacting with the leaders all over the country as well as with the troops, but My positive memories are of the workers, the troops who did the work, who were motivated not by wearing the best of clothes, not by living in the most expensive apartments, but were motivated by just serving the needs of the community, creating a better life for the people. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. It does.
You know, we can get back to some of my personal interactions about being the doctor for 4 years. It was, you know, you're right that I should discuss some of the positive things, because there will be so many people doing books and things basically dogging the Panther Party and pointing all the negative aspects of the Panther Party, and I think that people should have a balanced view. And there were many, many positive things they did, and my wife was so, had pointed out to me that there were a bunch of thugs when I joined them, so I can always, there are always these negative views, because I think I was working with them right before I actually met her. I had gotten involved working with the Panther Party. 1970, and I met her when she got beat up, and we started going out after she got beat up in the courthouse, which I believe was the year that George Jackson got killed. I believe that was 71. Anyway, it's interesting. I didn't do a very good job. We left March the 6th, I think it was. We had a deal going where we flew to Vancouver. We were supposed to fly from Vancouver to Hong Kong. We were actually supposed to go before Nixon's trip. Nixon went, I believe, in the winter of 70. We were supposed to go before then, but the FBI didn't want us over there at the same time, and so they would never. We had to get the visas and. They would never let Elaine and Messiah into Canada to get the visas. And there was no way you get visas because the United States and China had no diplomatic relationship. And they wouldn't let us in until after Nixon had come back. In fact, Henry Kissinger Nixon was so perturbed about that he told Zhao and Lao that the Chinese government should stop having a relationship with American radicals. They did not want us to have any type of relationship with China. But when we flew into Vancouver, the airlines had told us we would not have to go through Canadian customs. We could go, since we were not staying there, which would make sense. But apparently the FBI had other ideas. Ed Montgomery was the newspaper. The FBI would have a newspaper correspondent that they would link things to, and he was the FBI's correspondent for the Chronicle. He did a big editorial, "Panthers Go to Black China," and I actually have that. I have that write up in there. And when we landed in Hong Kong, it was just all over the newspapers, Panthers and China, and they mentioned my name, and they said, rumor had it that Angela Davis was with us, because Angela Davis couldn't be with us, she was in prison, so I don't know how that rumor got started, but anyway, I was just looking at my diary, and March, it says, March the 7th, Tuesday morning, Tokyo Hilton, or the games pigs play. Landed in Vancouver, greeted by the hospital sign, welcome Hewitt Travel Group. The name of our group was the Hewitt Travel Group. It was named after Masai Hewitt, was leading the delegation. We were also greeted by a pious plot to split up the cadre, to deport the leadership and all the others as subversives. We were based on the creed, you have no rights in Canada. That's what they told us when we landed there. You have no rights in Canada. All black Panthers will be deported as subversive. The anti-subversive law in Canada had only been enforced against Canada. It's interesting, as a courtesy from the Canadian government, we sipped our coffee and tea as we awaited our deportation. However, the Canadian Pacific Airlines offered us to fly us to Hong Kong through Seattle, since they promised us that we'd not have to pass through Canadian immigration. I think they were anxious to avoid a $1 million lawsuit. L. Brodsky, who was one of L. Brodsky, who was one of Charles Gary's law partners, has threatened suing for $1 million. Anyway, so they flew us to Seattle, and we landed in Seattle. We agreed that, you know, the Panthers had 44 chapters, it was a very large organization, and so you could go to almost any major city, and there would be a chapter. We agreed and each chapter would have their local attorneys who supported them. So we agreed in Seattle by Panthers with their attorneys, and again the Pigs with their game. While a few Pigs searched our carry-on baggage, other Pigs hid in ambush in a vain attempt. They just basically were hiding with their weapons, trying to figure out whether they could create an incident so they could just vamp us. Anyway. Thanks to the Pig games, we landed in Tokyo too late to continue to Hong Kong. Apparently, Hong Kong had some type of rule that you couldn't fly into it after 12 midnight. So as guests of Northwest Orient, they kept us overnight in the Tokyo Hilton. We had to ignore the glaring CBS lights. Whenever we got off the plane, there would be all these cameramen shining lights in our face. Of course, we refused to talk to them. And so they got very angry at us because we wouldn't talk to them, but we would just go do that. Yeah. On March the 7th, we arrived at the Golden Gate Hotel, which was actually managed by the China Traveler Service. We had to go through a bunch of rude, abusive newspaper people, agents following us around. And it's interesting is when that's when I decided to learn how to use chopsticks. I had told my girlfriend at that particular time that she could use chopsticks. And I said, well, I'm not going to learn how to use chopsticks until I go to China. So when we arrived at the Golden Gate Hotel, I proceeded to, the whole group, the delegation, proceeded to learn how to use chopsticks. And I'm looking at my notes. Wednesday, March the 8th, free at last, crossed the border, 2-mile trip to Canton. Actually, we crossed a 2-mile train trip from Hong Kong at last. Free at last, home safe. Unlike Martin Luther King, we didn't have to die to go to the promised land. We have spent the day in Kowloon, Hong Kong, Canton, China. Now we were on our way to Peking. Yesterday we arrived in Kowloon. I think Kowloon is the little place you go to before you cross the border into China. There the bourgeois press swarmed around us as if they were flies. Naturally, some of our bags were tampered with. But Comrade Law, the China Travel Service, began to know the beauty in the organization of the Chinese people. We rested the day in the Golden Gate Hotel. No, Kowloon is right across from Hong Kong. That's what it is. It's right next to Hong Kong. A thin island of safety from the bourgeois press.
Yeah. Oh.
Anyway, that.
Testing 1, 2, 3. It is May 10th, Mother's Day, and we are continuing our oral history with Dr. Talbert Small.
On the Wednesday, March the 8th, we took a train trip from Canton to the border, and about a 2-mile trip from the border, to Canton. It's amazing when we crossed the border, there were no Coca-Cola, no more Coca-Cola signs, no more signs of advertisement. We saw just a very tall, monumental white statue of Mao Zedong. In Canton, we stayed at a resort, a semi-tropical resort. We spent the day there and rested and relaxed. Then we flew on the next day, Thursday. We flew to Peking, at least. We arrived at Peking on on March the 9th. We visited a hospital. It's interesting, being a physician, the first place we visited, one of the first places we visited was a hospital in Peking. And we were in China for approximately 7 weeks, and we visited Canton, which is the opening door to the city of China. We visited Peking, we visited Yan'an, where the Mao stayed after the Long March. I believe he was there from about 1934 to approximately 1948. We visited the very caves that he lived and worked in. We visited Nanking, Sun Yat-sen's tomb, Shanghai, and we went to cultural events such as the Revolutionary Ballets, Red Detachment of Women. We saw around four different revolutionary operas, Little Red Soldiers, Tiger Mountain by Strategy. We visited many universities. The Institute of National Minorities. China has around about 54 minorities. The Han is 90% is the Han minority, but they had an institute where different minority people from Tibet and Mongolia would be studying their language and culture to go back and teach it. We visited factories such as locomotive factories, machine tool plants, visited hospitals in Peking, Shanghai, and discussed with them how they were able to get rid of TB, schistosomiasis. It was an eye-opening event from a person who had going into a completely different culture, completely, the Chinese government had just really gone through the Cultural Revolution. Of course, they were painting it as a very glorified time in their history in which they made positive changes in their society, and that the economy had skyrocketed. I later found out that was not true. That the Cultural Revolution was a time of much confusion and setbacks in the economy. But that's a different story. But let me go over some. One of the things that really impressed all of us was the integrity of the Chinese people. I think one of the guys in our group tried to throw away some shoes, and they wound up coming back in the next city. They tracked him down to give him the shoes back. Of the factories we visited a locomotive factory in Peking, and the workers retired at the age of 60 at 70% of the salary. If you were a conductor, you got to retire when you were 55. The women had maternity leave for 56 days, period. This particular locomotive factory was originally built by the Belgians, period. This particular locomotive factory hadn't been involved in a famous strike in 1923. It currently in period. It's interesting that after 1958, it just repaired locomotives. The Chinese used to state that prior to their liberation in 1949, they did not even have a factory to make a match, let alone a locomotive, period. We visited the locomotive factory on Friday, March the 10th, our second day in Peking, and full day in Peking. We were, of course, guests of the Chinese government, and I won't go over the specific details of the 7 weeks we were there, because I think you could write a book on that itself. But I'll just go through the high points. I think one of the high points was we had dinner at the Great Hall of the People, and on March the 27th, we were treated as guests of the government, and we met Gang Biao. He spells his name X-E-N-G-B-I-P as in Paul I-A-O. He was a member of the Central Committee and head of the international delegation. I assume that he was kind of like a foreign minister. And he talked to us a little bit about Chinese foreign policy. He talked about his relationship with India and his relationship with the Soviet Union. They considered the Soviet Union social imperialist because they thought there was socialism in name, imperialism in action. And his criticism was that the Soviet Union would lend people money and would charge them 3% interest rate, which they felt if they really wanted to help an underdeveloped country, they wouldn't try to make a profit off of lending them money. And I got some idea from even talking to Huddy Edwards how their foreign policy was just as arrogant as our foreign policy, in that they felt what was good for the Soviet Union was good for the rest of the world. And they wound up, when they were selling tractors to Ghana, they wound up selling them snow plows and snow tractors, and which is not what Ghana would need. And he also talked about his relationship with India. I won't go into details about it. He talked about this relationship between India and Bangladesh. I was very amazed when at the keen insight they had into the Black Panther Party, because Gang Biao spoke perfect English, and he told the Panther Party not to be concerned with splits, their unity through divisions, to purify themselves. They're just undergoing a big split. The Eldridge Cleaver faction had broken off from the party, and the New York Party, which was a very large party base, Huey had kicked the New York Panthers out, and they're New York 21 out. He felt that the Panther Party should persevere. He also felt they should practice self-criticism, something which was really lacking in the leadership of the party. They felt that they should recognize and learn from the mistake, and they felt that there were many revolutionary groups formed into one the correct line would attempt. And he advised the Panthers not to be dogmatic and secretive. I thought that was interesting, because the Panthers had a reputation of dealing with other groups from the point of view they felt they were the vanguard, and they were very dogmatic in dealing with other groups, and they felt that they should learn to unite groups as equals, and told them, don't tell other groups that we will unite to you if you will obey and follow our orders, but they should unite as equals. And apparently, I said to myself, here we are in Peking, China, and the foreign minister of China knows exactly about the dogmatism and the way the Panther Party related with other progressive organizations. And in China, in the United States, Nixon had gone to China that winter, and he talked about Nixon's trip. He said it was ironic that Nixon, who made his reputation as being an anti-communist and red baiter, should ask to come to China. They felt Nixon wanted to go to China because he thought it would help him politically at home. He thought Nixon was interested in opening the door to trade with China. And plus, there were 1 million Russian troops on the border with China. And they felt Nixon felt that whoever is the enemy of his enemy could be his friend. And they thought that was why Nixon wanted to go to China, and their attitude was, who are we to deny him to come to China if he wants to come to China? That was kind of their attitude about Nixon's trip to China. Mm-hmm. Going to China opened my door to acupuncture is how I became one of the first doctors in this country to do it. And we got exposed to acupuncture somewhat in Yunnan, when we visited Yunnan, which was the Chinese Communist Party basically functioned for approximately 13 years, I believe, 14 years. But we visited the Workers' Pest and Soldiers Hospital in Peking on March the 20th, and I got to see subtotal gastrectomy, a thyroidectomy, and a detached retina, and acupuncture surgery. And Dr. Choi, I think, was the head of the revolutionary committee at the hospital. He actually sat and talked to us about acupuncture. At that time, they were using acupuncture in this particular hospital as the majority of the surgery there. He felt it was safe, the patients could cooperate better, they could recover faster. He felt there were disadvantages, that there was incomplete analgesia, muscle spasm, traction on the intestines could cause pain. And we also visited a very famous case, which I later saw in the pictures when it came back. It's a 30-year-old woman whose right foot was smashed and the left leg was smashed. And so they sewed on her right foot to the left lower leg, which is a very interesting operation.
What?
They sewed her right foot on to the left lower leg.
You saw that?
Yeah, we saw this lady. And so she later got a prosthesis for the right leg and she was walking. They did the first transplant of hands and fingers. And China, actually, the surgeon we met in Shanghai, which I won't go into detail about it, but he was the first one in the world to sew hands and feet back on, and he had about a 60% success rate with fingers and 80% with hands and feet.
Wow.
And the operation could, you know, it was a very long operation, about 24 hours, and we were back to China. So when I saw these operations, I realized there was something to it, because we saw a person actually, after sitting up and talking while he was having his thyroidectomy, so they know they wouldn't cut the recurrent laryngeal nerve. They told us they didn't use acupuncture cancer surgery because it was regional analgesia, relief to pain. You didn't know how far the cancer occurred and spread. They had, at that time, they told us that they were treating certain types of deafness with acupuncture and deaf mute school. I later found out that in their scientific journals that this was not the case, but at that time they were claiming to have treated it with acupuncture. They also talked about how they had wiped out TB by giving the BCG shot to every newborn baby. And so, of course, this opened up the doors to acupuncture surgery in Peking. And so when we traveled to Shanghai, I think I claimed to have a stiff neck. I didn't have a stiff neck, but I just wanted acupuncture treatment. I got acupuncture treatment. And the acupuncturist stuck a needle in what's called gallbladder 20 behind the occipital bone. I felt a numbness shooting up my head, and my neck stiffness got better. The thing that I remember about Shanghai was we went to the foreign session, called BUND Bond Park, and there was a bridge you would go across, and the Chinese still had the sign up in place. No dogs or Chinese allowed. They said they kept that sign up because the people wanted the people to be aware of the previous oppression that they had under foreign domination in Shanghai. And generally, I was very impressed by the integrity of the people. I'd mentioned earlier about the shoe incidents in which the shoes were brought back. You know, the people would find wristwatch, camera, and money, and they would turn it over to the police. And we were talking, I guess, in Shanghai, I think it was in Shanghai, and they noticed The police noted at the end of the year that they had four wristwatches which were not returned. So one policeman used his spare time, holiday time, to go through all the police stations looking for people who lost the wristwatches until he found all four wristwatches and had returned it. It's very interesting how the integrity seemed to be so much part of the culture then. And as I understand it now, China has major problems with corruption. And corruption is not only in the party officials, but in the businessmen. Corruption appears to be widespread in China today.
Mm.
Period. As you know, I've been doing acupuncture for the last 25 years, and probably am an expert on it. Probably I've been done it more than most people in this country. And we met Dr. Wu in Shanghai, who was a professor at the traditional acupuncture school. And he basically gave us two lectures, taught us how to do simple acupuncture points. He told, let me understand that it was simple, that anyone could learn it in a month, that someone would take the time out to teach them. I thought, you know, I don't think for your paper I should go to the specifics of the point, everything, but that was something I brought back to me and built on was the fact that I got my foundation through acupuncture.
In China.
In China, period. You know, you asked me what it was like traveling to Black Panther. I was a member of the party, and my wife had a lot of, had friends who had joined the party in high school who were beaten up and told me enemies of the people. And she felt that I would really learn a lot about the party. I remember I was one lady who was high up in the party. She was from Boston. She had about four or five coats with us. And I was saying to myself, my God, why would she travel with four or five coats? Especially someone who was supposed to be a revolutionist. But, you know, when you travel with people, you really get to know people, and there were good, hard-working people in the party. But I thought that, you know, the party had a lot of problems, not so much with the leadership, Masai Hewitt or Emory Douglas were traveling with us, but with the people who were not with us. And I thought it's interesting the way they did it. There may have been about 20 people or so on the trip. I don't remember exactly, but each person, there would always be two in a room, and they would always have one party person with one non-party person. The guy who was my roommate was Maurice. He was from the Panther Party in Memphis. So the people who weren't in the party felt that this is what the people of the party were doing, to keep an eye on the people who were not in the party, which I thought was an interesting comment by some of my colleagues who were quote community workers and were not in the party.
Impact your life, you know. Could be one way to describe.
Could you repeat the question?
If there could be one way to just sum up in a couple of sentences how this trip, you know, what was the most valuable thing you learned on this trip about yourself, about the people you traveled with, about China, you know, how did that impact your life? How did that change you upon your return? You know, you mentioned acupuncture.
I learned about the benefits. I learned about socialism in practice. You know, no country's all good or bad, but I know this country was trying to provide health care and education for its people. And you have to keep in mind that we're trying to feed all of its people. You have to keep in mind that China is a country that has almost 25% of the world's population.
Mm.
And that's a tremendous undertaking, especially since it's a country that's never really known democracy. And it's never really, you know, at the time, prior to their revolution, there were people who go along the cities and pick up the bodies of babies. In fact, women who had girl daughters would frequently put them out on the streets because it was considered male children were more valuable and they would put female kids out on as babies out on the street to die. And, you know, and so, and there was tremendous poverty in how they were organized to, medically to control TB throughout the country, how deaf areas where there was schistosomiasis, how they would, we were lectured by, I probably won't go through the details, but they had an anti-snail campaign, and I believe it was in Shanghai. They lectured, it was either in Shanghai or Nanking, they lectured to us about how they wiped out the snails from the carriers for the schistosomiasis parasite. And how, you know, and how all governments should try to serve the needs of the people and provide services for the people rather than exploiting the people. I think that made a big impression on me. Also, I realized traveling with the Panthers that they themselves and their organizational structures had a lot of personal problems and that, you know, that in some respects they, granted that there are a lot of negative things in the Cultural Revolution, they probably could have used the Cultural Revolution where they kind of got some new leadership in the organization. But that's, I think, what impressed me most was going to a socialist country where people were enthused about building socialism. We had, after we had came back from China, Nola and I went to Europe the next year, which was 73, and China, everything was clean. When we crossed the border to Hungary, I was surprised how filthy the place was where we were going to get our visas. And I was also how the people did not...
Hungary was filthy?
Yeah. Now, I also was how the people really were not enthused about socialism.
In Hungary.
In fact, Noli's cousin, a lady who was married to Noli's grandfather, or I say step-grandmother, I guess she used to be married to her cousin, seemed to get the feeling with her that everything, there was a lot of bribery, and that if you wanted something, you would pay, you would have to pay someone bribery to get it, and that's just a, that was the overall thing that impressed me. While I was working with the Panther Party between 1970 and 1974, I worked at the West Oakland House between 1970 to 73, and I think we talked about this earlier. I worked there 6 hours a day. It was basically, I believe it was a HUD-funded place that was basically would treat people on a sliding scale or theoretically free if they had no money, and would bill Medi-Cal, Medicare, and, ironically, I was making $15 an hour. That seemed like a lot of money in 1970. I guess it was a lot of money in 1970. You asked me about the sickle cell. I think it was Bobby Seale's idea, anyway, to get involved dramatizing the neglect of sickle cell anemia. We used an article that was published in JAMA to dramatize this, because at that time they got, the entire country was spending about $7.9 million on muscular dystrophy, $1.9 million on cystic fibrosis, and only around $50,000 on sickle cell anemia. So we, there were about, I think, 44 or 45 Black Panther chapters, and I believe there were 9 free clinics. So we set up sickle cell testing. I set up a board of directors. I had Dr. Linus Pauling was on the board of directors. Ossie Davis's brother, I believe.
What year was this?
This was, I believe, 71. It was the year that I did the article for the Panther newspaper.
Okay.
Sickle cell, on sickle cell anemia. And we pushed it so that it actually forced Richard Nixon to put money into sickle cell anemia. In fact, he got out on the before Congress and said sickle cell anemia was a very neglected disease, a disgrace, and he pushed through $6 million through sickle cell anemia. Now, every major city that has a large Black population has a sickle cell anemia foundation, and although there's no cure for sickle cell anemia, the patients are living longer, and they're certainly, you know, are medically being treated better than they were prior to the Sickle Cell Anemia Foundation being set up.
And you said that Northern Medical School satisfied their quotas by admitting one or two black students, and Southern Medical Schools traditionally admitted no black students. It's really ironic that you wrote this as your perspective in 1969, because it's almost 1980. I mean, it's almost 1999, and we see the same thing happening today with the disease of affirmative action. It's no longer, and people could openly admit how they feel about minority students, and I really feel a sense of urgency, especially in the black community, who is going to be servants to these people, because I do see a lot of black doctors, you know, I go to Stinkley Miller's, you know, and I don't really see a lot of doctors as dedicated as you. I see a lot of people that are interested in money, you know, and that's all good, but I don't, and see a lot of people that are really dedicated to making changes in their communities. And it really hurts me, especially since there is no more affirmative action anymore, because...
That's only for California.
You know.
And Texas, and they're working on Michigan now.
But they're working. It's setting precedents. You see people, you know.
You know, this country is the master at practicing... racism and death squads and mass murder and calling it democracy. You know, we had legalized racism for most of our center, most of our history. In fact, the talk I gave with Paul Robeson, I remarked that when Paul Robeson was born, 1898, that there was no NAACP, Urban League, Black Panther Party, SNCC. In that apartheid and racism was a legal law of our country. Teddy Roosevelt said that we needed to have a race war. Woodrow Wilson, who, when Paul Robeson's father asked him to let him go to Princeton, said he was president. While he was president of Princeton, they would never have a black student in Princeton. There were all these wealthy Southern kids to go there. Woodrow Wilson told a black delegation that the segregation was actually to the advantage of the black folks. And President Coolidge and President Harding were members of the Ku Klux Klan. In the early 1940s, around 1940, Walter White was head of the NAACP, asked Franklin Roosevelt to come out with an anti-lynching war, and Franklin said he couldn't do it. He couldn't take the political risk and chance of opposing a lynching by law. So this it was just legalized racism. And thanks to a very conservative former governor of California, Earl Warren, who as the deal he had with Eisenhower was he would endorse Eisenhower, and Eisenhower would become president, he would become Chief Justice when the position opened. And so Eisenhower made him Chief Justice. Well, 1954, he got Plessy versus Ferguson, the overthrow of
Brown versus the Board of Education.
He got the overthrow of the separate but equal laws. But you know, we always and so now we don't we no longer have legal racism, but we have a way of being racist.
De facto.
As you said, de facto. For instance, when I was going to medical school, they used the Wayne State, which used to use the MCAT exam to keep black folks who had good grades from getting in, because the MCAT exam was a cultural-based exam. They asked you about Italian opera Mozart. They would ask you about
MCAT.
They would ask you about Mozart. And they could screen out it's exam which how well you did, that probably depends a lot on your income and cultural background. And I suspect the SAT exams probably are also tied into people's income, whether they can afford to take courses to refresher courses, which are expensive, where they can afford to take the exam more than once, and the, how they can use class to keep minorities and poor folks out of these schools, and they can use this as a way of equal rights and justice. They can, we've learned how to package and sanitize racism as equal rights and justice. Like we push for democracy and human rights throughout the world, but the 200,000 people that were Indians before some Indians were murdered in Guatemala, the death squads did not come from communist countries such as Cuba or Russia or China. The death squads were made in the USA. In the Phoenix program, pointed out thousands of people who were murdered. In Indonesia, the CIA pointed out over 1 million people who were murdered by present dictators, Suharto, because they were leftists or communists. They thought they lost China, they weren't going to use Indonesia. And so, ironically, we use code words like democracy, equality, to justify our racism. We're doing the same thing with the anti-affirmative action law. It's called, quote, an equal rights law. Anyway, the point we're making, how you have to judge countries and people by their actions and not their words. And we use democracy as a code word for, quote, capitalism. Ironically, we lost 50,000 Americans, 500,000 Vietnamese because of the federal domino effect that the Vietnam would go communist, all of Southeast Asia would go communist. It's all basically about money. I think Mrs. Lyndon Johnson's wife owned the two construction companies that did all the construction for Americans and Vietnam. Instead of getting all these people killed, we could have just sent over Coca-Cola and Nike. In Vietnam now, Nike can operate without fear of labor unions and have, abused children and abused women in their factories, all in a communist country. And it's ironically that if we really wanted to make changes in Cuba, we would stop the blockade and send in Coca-Cola, send in Nike. By the time Nike and Coca-Cola got through with Cuba, they would have the same type of market economy that Vietnam and China has. In life we have to judge nations by what they do and not what they say, and we have to judge people by what they do and not what they say. Do you have any further good questions?
About your feelings on healthcare today. Briefly, maybe you might want to talk about that. I mean, if you don't, that's fine. I know you've been
to me in the past. Yeah, we could talk
about
healthcare today.
187 insurance companies, stuff like that.
You know, obviously this country
is
does
on?
So little with so much. We spend 16% of our gross national product on healthcare, and about 4% of that goes for administration and profit. We have situations where the average CEO can make HMO can make $8 million, and I think you open a Pandora's box, can make can make a $6 million salary. One head of CEO make $8 million in salary. QualMed merged with HealthNet, the neurologist in Denver got $275 million in stock options. When the merger took place, 1 year, the top insurance companies with their stock options. They made $2.4 billion in the entire nation, public and private, only spent $1.4 billion on AIDS research.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me to speak about health care, you really open a Pandora's box, you know. Money that should be going to provide health care goes into the profits of the blood barons who control the HMOs and control insurance companies, and they have their lobbyists in Washington, and they control the politicians. To me, this is not democracy, this is exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any quick fixes. I suspect South Africa may have some type of a socialized health care program before we will. It's ironic that even little Cuba, with its kind of population of 20 million, in spite of the embargo, they have 7.2, I believe, deaths per 1,000. In some parts of Oakland, we probably have around
about mortality.
Infant mortality rate of 15 to 16.
Yeah, I was reading they have a lower infant mortality rate than Washington, D.C.
Per 1,000. And I'm sure they have a lower infant mortality rate than East Oakland. I think our health care situation here is a disgrace, but I think that we can tell the big lie if someone tries to put a health care reform initiative in a ballot. Only 49% of the people vote, and the 26th or 27th.
Lincoln was wrong.
I think Lincoln was wrong to a certain extent, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Look at the way the American people vote when they vote against their own needs. They vote such as health care reform.